I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Stephen Smith, the executive director of the Shoah Foundation. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. After a week of matzah and seders and services and unleavened everything, Passover is absolutely over now. And as my wife and I returned our kitchen to its year-round chametz status, we discovered, as we do every year, that we had lots of boxes of uneaten matzah. You know, you buy the 5 pounds of boxes of matzah because it's a much better deal, and you need a couple of boxes for Seder, and then no matter what you eat, you always end up with at least 2 boxes at the end of Passover, just when you really don't want to see matzah again for a very long time. So, what do you do? How do you use up all those boxes of the unleavened bread of intestinal affliction? Well, to play us in this morning, in her now classic little song, Michelle Citron tells you 20 things you can do with matzah after Passover's over.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzah pick and play the guitar, and you can make a matzah license plate for your car. Use it as a coaster when you're drinking your beer, or you can throw it as confetti for a happy new year.
Insulate.
Decorate.
9. Exfoliate.
10.
Constipate.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Crumble up some matzah to line your hamster cage, or you can use it as a bookmark to hold your page. Break a stack of matzah when you practice your karate. Build a matzah doghouse for your doggy named Scotty. Make a little matzah board and wave it goodbye. Or you can make a pair of matzah wings and learn how to fly. Wear some matzah jewelry. Make a picture frame for me. Have a drink of matzah tea. Matzah's all that I can see. There's just one more thing to do with unleavened bread. You can eat it, 'cause it ain't all that bad.
That was Michelle Citron's quite wonderful 20 things to do with matzah after Passover's over. By the way, it's worth your time to watch the YouTube cut of that song. It's really funny. If Passover's over as it is, that means we are now in the period of the counting of the Omer, the time between Pesach, the festival of freedom, and Shavuot, the holiday of covenant and Torah. For the 7 weeks between Passover and Shavuos, we take a few moments each evening to say a blessing and count the days that lead us towards a reaffirmation of our Brit, our covenant with God as certified at Mount Sinai. As a passage in Proverbs says, teach us to number our days that we can make each day count. The counting of the Omer reminds us that we have the capacity to make every single day matter, to bring holiness into our lives every day. In the Sfirat HaOmer, the prayer that we chant each night, there's a famous passage, Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, may the temple be rebuilt speedily in our day. It's a classic text, but more than that, it's a metaphor for what we wish in our own lives during this time of the year, holiness and sanctity, a kind of small sanctuary in the midst of the trials and tribulations of daily life. May we continually seek to rebuild ourselves and our world at this time of year and always. Sheyabona Beis Hamikdash, as sung by cantor Ben Sion Miller.
Sheyabona Beis Hamikdash, Imeru Veyomenu, Tisein Chelkenu Besoro Secho. Sheyabona Beis Hamikdash, Imeru Veyomenu, Yehir
That was Sheyabona Beis Hamikdash, a classic concert piece sung by Chazan Ben Sion Miller, a true great cantorial tenor, for this period of the counting of the Omer. We are also coming up on the Holocaust Commemoration Day, Yom HaShoah, which begins tonight. To put this event into perspective, a few personal stories. I remember as a little boy waiting in line at the Jewish bakery in the market near my home, and seeing women reach up to get their loaves of rye bread or challah or boxes of cookies from the bakers, and seeing tattooed on their arms the numbers that the Nazis had given them in the camps. My first singing job, as I recall, was at a commemoration of the martyrs of the Vilna Ghetto, where I sang a Holocaust song in Yiddish. And I particularly recall when I was a college student at UCLA, there was an incident in which Armenian students actually planted a bomb in the office of a Turkish history professor, his name was Shaw, as I vaguely remember, who was ignoring the Armenian genocide in his lectures. That bomb was discovered before it went off, and I was talking about the events with my parents and said, you know, if 98 members of my family had been murdered by someone, I might have planted a bomb too. And my parents answered, we probably lost close to 400 members of our extended family during the Holocaust. It brought home to me the fact that the Shoah has had a profound impact on the history of the world, but particularly on the history of our Jewish people and our population today, even. 6 million Jewish victims of the Nazis have not easily been replaced. We now have 13 million Jews in the entire world. And were it not for the Shoah, many think that population would be 32 million, nearly triple the current number. Before the Holocaust, the rate of Jews in the world was 8 per 1,000 people. Today, it is 2 per 1,000. There is almost no way to overstate the impact of the Shoah, its evil, and it is imperative that we preserve the memory of that destruction and the great communities who were lost. Our own Southern Arizona community's Yom HaShoah will be observed at My Temple Emmanuel this very afternoon at 2 p.m. in the Rubin Family Sanctuary. This year marks an interesting anniversary in the experience of the Shoah. 20 years ago, Steven Spielberg created the Shoah Foundation, 1 year after his film Schindler's List was a huge artistic and commercial success. It was Spielberg's goal that the Shoah Foundation document every survivor in the world on video. And over time, they've almost managed to complete this Herculean task. Our guest this morning, Stephen Smith, is the wonderful executive director of the Shoah Foundation. He'll explain the remarkable mission of this outstanding organization, how they do their complicated work, all when we return on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU. Dream it. Do it. Visit asu.edu.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Stephen Smith is executive director of the Shoah Foundation, the USC Shoah Foundation, I should say, in Los Angeles, which has done such remarkable work documenting and recording the stories of Holocaust survivors in a way that really no one has ever done before. They're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Schindler's List film, which in a way started the whole project. Good morning and welcome, Stephen.
Good morning to you, Rabbi.
Tell me, what do you think the most important accomplishment of the Shoah Foundation has been to date?
Well, without doubt, it's the fact that over 52,000 survivors and witnesses of the Shoah gave not only their testimony, but bequeathed a part of their life as a witness to the Shoah, but also as a gift to the world. And the fact that those testimonies today are now available for people to be able to listen to and to learn from is a remarkable achievement. And really, it's the achievement of those survivors who, you know, gave us a very important gift.
You know, as the last survivors eventually passed from the scene, you know, we're experiencing it now. How many more are there who have not yet told their story to the Shoah Foundation?
Well, there are thousands of survivors who, you know, 20 years ago when the Shoah Foundation began, maybe didn't feel quite yet the courage to be able to tell their testimony to a wider audience. So we don't really know. Day by day, we hear from people who, you know, still would like to give their testimony, and when we can, we do. But what we know is that those that have given their testimony and maybe have now left us, we are very grateful for the fact that they did do that, because we're able to use that for a very important educational purpose in the world.
How many survivors have given testimony to the Shoah Foundation?
It's 52,000, more or less, which not only from the United States of America, but in fact from 56 countries in 32 languages. So it's really a global archive of testimony in which people from Jewish people who went through the Shoah experienced a whole variety of different experiences, from the camps to hiding in the forest to being partisans, and so many different experiences. We also have testimony from those who weren't Jewish, who experienced the camps and the persecution of the Nazis as well, including political prisoners and Roma, who experienced Nazi persecution, and many other groups.
The gypsies, homosexuals, political prisoners, what number of those testimonies have you all taken?
Well, of the 52,000 testimonies, 48,500 of those are actually Jewish witnesses,
right,
to the Holocaust. The rest are broken down as follows. About 1,500 or so are rescuers, people who risked their lives to save Jews during the Holocaust, and a remarkable, remarkable group of people. And then the rest, actually the largest group is around about 450 testimonies of Roma, mainly actually still living in Eastern Europe today, and, you know, still part of those communities where they experienced Nazi persecution, actually. Only four of them in English taken in the United States, most of them taken in Eastern Europe.
We will talk much more with Stephen Smith, Executive Director of the USC Shoah Foundation, and hear some of those remarkable stories when we come back here on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is coming up fast, June 11th to June 23rd, 2014. It's probably your last chance to sign up if you're interested in going with me on this fabulous journey to Israel. You'll see it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to Masada to Jerusalem. Email tojewishradio18, tojewishradio18@gmail, or call 520-327-4501 for more information and how to sign up. Our Jewish poetry slam this morning comes from the Italian Jewish Holocaust survivor, Primo Levi, a chemist who became an extraordinary author and poet. It is his remarkable poem, Shema. You who live secure in your warm houses, who return at evening to find hot food and friendly faces, consider whether this is a man who labors in the mud, who knows no peace, who fights for a crust of bread, who dies at a yes or a no. Consider whether this is a woman without hair or name, with no more strength to remember, eyes empty and womb cold as a frog in winter. Consider that this has been. I commend these words to you. Engrave them on your hearts when you are in your house, when you walk on your way, when you go to bed and when you rise. Repeat them to your children. Or may your house crumble. Disease render you powerless. Your offspring avert their faces from you. That was Primo Levi's beautiful, painful poem on the Holocaust, Shema. You know, my friends, I had the privilege of hearing Ed Asner read that poem at our Freedom Seder, the one we led together last Monday during Passover. While I am not nearly the reader or actor Ed Asner is, that poem itself is such a powerful reminder. It is our responsibility to remember and to preserve the memory of those who died and of those who survived. We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Shalom, Rabbi.
So we've had wonderful festivals, Pesach, Mamuna, very happy celebrations. Today, we're commemorating something much more serious, Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day. Can you talk a little bit about what the Shoah means for Israel today?
Yeah, and I will start with like a very Israeli narrative, I would say, that without the Shoah, maybe we won't have like the right to live in Israel right now. And I would say that usually we would say like in a few days from now, we would say Yom HaZikaron, like Memorial Day for soldiers, we would say Bemotam tzivu lanu et ha'chaim, with their death that they
gave us life.
And not that they had a choice, but they sacrificed their life and they gave us land, not just life, but, you know, they gave us, you know, the land of Israel.
Right.
And so in Israel, Yom HaShoah has a double, not so different meaning. First, of course, we remember each and every one, and most of us will go to the Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum, or we'll have, of course, the Tzfirah, the siren.
There's a two-minute-long siren, very long siren.
Yeah, 8 p.m.
In the whole country, very loud.
Yeah, and 2 minutes, 8 p.m., and 10 a.m. Next day, and everyone will stop. Car will pull aside and will go and will stand like for 2 minutes, and yeah, it's a different. You won't see it here. Like a whole nation will really commemorate and remember, you know, the Holocaust survivor. I just want to fix. It used to be twice at, but I at the
8 p.m. And then 10 in the morning.
Yeah, and. And the second, that it's not so different, but the second, it's really to remember that we have even more responsibility and commitment to, you know, to defend and to save our country, because they really sacrificed, six million Jew, you know, sacrificed their life or gave their life, and we had the country, you know, as an
Yeah, you
outcome.
Know, and I think that people don't really understand the connection. It's not that it's connected, that may be the wrong way to say it, but with the Holocaust does not occur, I don't think the world, the United Nations, agrees to form the State of Israel in 1948.
I think most of Israeli will agree with you. That's why we feel that, you know, much more responsibility, because we connect these two events, that 3 years after the Holocaust, the
end of World War II,
Israel was established. Yeah, we are connecting these two events, and that's why we feel that we commemorate in each and every one of them, and we also remember that we owe them that they gave us the land,
this country. Oshrat, thank you very much for a great and a serious contemplation on this Yom HaShoah commemoration day.
Yeah, nitreh b'smachot.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We talked the last couple of weeks about migration, immigration in this sector. The truth is, most American Jews trace their lineage to people who migrated to America at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Many of us, we say, oh, our ancestors came from Russia, or Russia, Poland. But what we really mean frequently is not that, but the Ukraine or thereabouts.
Right. The Tsarist Empire, if you will, lands under control of the Russian Tsar. And ultimately, that wave of immigration was not due to happenstance or even due to poverty. It was due to a series of state-sponsored pogroms following the assassination of the Tsar at the beginning of the 1880s. And basically,
I think I had relatives involved in one of those.
I'm sure we all did. But basically, Before that, pogroms were kind of popularly inspired by drunken louts and peasants who went on a pillage against local Jews. And they weren't actually carried out by government officials, be they police or military or whatever. It wasn't a matter of state policy. In the 1880s, it became state policy. And then the Russian government passed the so-called May Laws, which held the Jews responsible for the violence that was committed by Russians against them. And the Jewish communities had to pay back the cost of the damage inflicted by the Russians.
I mean, on them.
It was horrible. Yeah. And many Jews concluded that there was no longer a place for them in the Tsar's empire. And so, I mean, one thing that happened with some of these Jews is ultimately they went to Israel. Another thing that happened was they often lived in remote places that didn't have train stations, and obviously there were no airports in, and they had no money. So they set out on foot for whatever the nearest country was, which could have been Romania or the Austro-Hungarian Empire or Prussia, whatever. And they ended up in places like Berlin, Warsaw, Budapest, Bratislava, Prague, Vienna, etc. And there, they became a source of acute embarrassment often to newly emancipated Jews who for maybe 20, 30, 40 years had been free to practice as lawyers and doctors and whatever. And suddenly these like old world Jews who reminded them of their grandparents or great grandparents came, and the reaction was almost universally, gee, it's a shame these poor Jews are suffering. They don't speak our language. They don't fit in here. And they're going to cause a new wave of anti-Semitism. How do we get rid of them? So the community set up organizations to raise funds to buy these people train tickets to ports like Hamburg and Bremen and whatever, or Rotterdam, and then send them to the new world, mostly the U.S., but also Argentina, Canada, South Africa, whatever.
Mexico. Very
so in the years between the late 80s and the outbreak of World War I, something like half the Jews in the world moved from the Tsarist lands to somewhere in the New World. And this was probably the biggest mass migration of Jews since the Exodus from Egypt. And it is to that Exodus that most of us can trace our roots here in America. I mean, granted, we have some Sephardic Jews who came from other places. We have Jews who came from Israel. We have Jews who came from all over the world in this large and diverse Jewish community. But most Jews that you and I know have at least one grandparent or great-grandparent who came here as a result of that wave of emigration.
Yeah, I have three of four, so not atypical. Thanks, Tom. We will continue this next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Little David came back from Hebrew school, and his dad asked, "What'd you learn today, David?" And he answered, "The rabbi told us how Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt." "Oh, that's great, David. How do you do it?" So David answered his dad, "Moses was a big, strong man, and he beat Pharaoh up. Then, when he was down, he got all the people together and ran to the sea. When he got there, he had the Corps of Engineers build a huge pontoon bridge. Once they got to the other side, they blew up the bridge while the Egyptians were on it, trying to cross." Father was a little startled. "Is that what the rabbi taught you?" And the boy replied, "No, but you'd never believe the story he did tell us." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Emor, our portion this week in Leviticus, begins as so many others do, with God giving commands to the people of Israel. But the language this time is a little different. Usually commandments begin with the Hebrew word daber, speak to the children of Israel, or occasionally tzav, command the children of Israel. But this time the much softer word emor, say to the priests, the children of Aaron, is used. Why? There's a clue in the continuation of the first sentence of our portion. The Seder actually begins, "say to the priest," and then adds, "and say to them." As the commentators do not believe the Torah is ever truly redundant, the Talmud teaches that there's a subtle message here. be cautious in how we adults speak to children. Amor means to speak softly and kindly. Good advice, always, in instructing children. But why specifically is this word amor used twice in regard to the priestly commands? After all, priests are not children. Perhaps the essence lies in the central message of holiness given to our ancestors, articulated so beautifully at the start of last week's portion of Kiddushim. You shall all be holy, for I, God, am holy. Here in Emor, as the specifics of the designated representatives of the people in holiness are articulated, the change to softer language is notable. The priests are the one who actually have to help the people achieve holiness. They now must be given the careful, scrupulous requirements, but also inspired to do that work with devotion and passion and kindness. Thus, Emor, speak, explain, teach, and inspire, not simply daber, tell, command, order, require. In leading someone towards holiness, in both ethics and spirit, there must be a serious, conscientious devotion to quality, but there must also be inspiration and caring, even perhaps especially a love for the process and the result. This week of Emor, may we be inspired to seek holiness in our lives and in our practice, and to seek to inspire others to do so as well. The Shoah Foundation was created out of whole cloth by Steven Spielberg 20 years ago. Its considerable mission, preserving the voices and images of the survivors of the Holocaust everywhere and for all time, has mostly been achieved. And now it has a number of new and important goals. Find out what those are and how they continue to preserve, perpetuate, and spread memory from Stephen Smith, the executive director of the Shoah Foundation, when we return here on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU. Dream it. Do it. Visit asu.edu.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Palestinian factions Hamas and Fatah, in charge respectively of Gaza and the West Bank, signed what has been called a historic unity agreement last week. That accord, not the first between the warring Palestinian factions who have been fighting for the leadership of the Palestinians quietly and much more openly for over 7 years, has the two sides agreeing to form a united government and hold elections later this year. Mind you, there was a similar agreement signed in 2011 that blew up quite quickly. This particular one, the new one, was signed by Mahmoud Abbas, the Fatah leader and the president of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and Ismail Haniyeh, the prime minister of Hamas and the guy in control of Gaza. It's not clear how all this will play out, but it almost certainly means that the John Kerry-brokered Israeli-Palestinian peace talks of the last few months are dead. Under U.S. law, Hamas is recognized as a terror group, and America cannot legally continue to supply financial aid to any terrorist group. The U.S. has been supporting Abbas's Palestinian Authority in a variety of ways for some time. It may now be legally prevented from continuing that aid. Israel immediately responded by saying Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas was moving to peace with Hamas instead of peace with Israel. He has to choose, said Bibi Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel. Does he want peace with Hamas or peace with Israel? You can have one, but not the other. I hope he chooses peace, but so far, he hasn't done so. After the agreement was announced, Israel canceled a planned session of negotiations with the Palestinians. It also launched an airstrike on a site in the north of the Gaza Strip. In many ways, this accord seems like an act of desperation by Hamas, which has become increasingly isolated and unstable in the wake of the fall of its allies, the Muslim Brotherhood, in Egypt last year, and its embarrassment in the Israeli military operations in Gaza before that. The new military government in Cairo has blocked up many of the smuggling tunnels leading to Gaza and forced Hamas into even more intense austerity measures. Just why Abbas is taking Fatah and the Palestinian Authority into an agreement with its Islamist archenemies right now is anybody's guess. If it is not to increase his leverage in talks with Israel, which is possible, but maybe not such a likely motivation, it seems like yet another example of the Palestinian leadership's refusing to embrace a possible peaceful solution to its many challenges. As U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said, it's hard to see how Israel can be expected to negotiate with a government that doesn't believe in its right to exist. The root of recent conflict between the two largest Palestinian movements follows the 2006 elections, which Hamas won, but the West, Israel, and Abbas largely refused to recognize. So Hamas violently asserted control of Gaza in 2007, killing many Fatah gunmen and some innocent people and expelling the others, and leaving Abbas in charge of only parts of the West Bank. Since then, both sides have become entrenched in their own territories, setting up respective governments and security forces of their own and arresting their rivals. The Israeli Foreign Ministry Intelligence Wing believes that in spite of the new official accord, Palestinian reconciliation is far from being implemented, believing that the gaps between Hamas and Fatah are still much too wide. We will see if this new accord lasts and if it actually means anything. Well, news hoaxes can be perpetuated even on Jews. Last week, we briefly reported to you that in a town in Ukraine, Donetsk, anti-Semitic flyers were circulated that required all Jews to register or face a fine. It turns out this was all a nasty hoax perpetrated by those who wish to discredit the pro-Russian protesters in the area, who are scary enough on their own without being accused of following Nazi practices. I think it's someone trying to use the Jewish community in Donetsk as an instrument in this conflict. That's why we're upset, said the chief rabbi, Pinchas Vyshedsky. According to Jewish community members at Donetsk-only synagogue, founded 110 years ago in Ukraine, three masked men walked up to worshippers standing on the street after a Pesach service on Wednesday morning and tried to distribute the flyers. They wore no insignia and quickly left when asked to identify themselves. The flyer demands all Jewish citizens age 16 and older register with the Donetsk Republic Commissar for Nationality Affairs and pay a $50 fee, given that the leaders of the Jewish community of Ukraine support the Banderite junta in Kiev and are hostile to the Orthodox Donetsk Republic and its citizens. Those who refuse to register will be deprived of citizenship and forcibly expelled from the republic, and their property will be confiscated, this hoax flyer read. The order was allegedly issued by People's Governor Denis Pushilin, who denied that the Donetsk People's Republic had anything to do with the flyer. There are actually about 15,000 Jews in Donetsk. It's a frightening time for everyone in Ukraine now, but at least this dark chapter should be closed. There's plenty of potential trouble for Jews in Ukraine, which has a very ugly anti-Semitic past, without creating new problems that may not really exist. In other unpleasant news, five Haredi ultra-Orthodox Jewish men were indicted for attacking a gay black man in Brooklyn back in December. These five were charged in New York State Supreme Court in Brooklyn last week with gang assault and other counts for the December attack, but not with hate crimes. They were associated with a civilian neighborhood watch group, the Williamsburg Safety Patrol Unit, or Shomrim. Taj Patterson, a 22-year-old student at the New York City College of Technology, said he was walking through the heavily Orthodox neighborhood of Williamsburg on his way home to a nearby neighborhood when more than 12 Hasidic men attacked him while shouting anti-gay slurs. He said he suffered a broken eye socket, torn retina, blood clotting, and cuts and bruises to his knees and ankles. The five men indicted were Aharon Hollander, Abraham Winkler, Meir Herskovich, Pinchas Braver, and Joseph Fried, all between 19 and 28 years old. If convicted, they each face up to 25 years in prison. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. He's Stephen Smith, the executive director of the USC Shoah Foundation, founded because of the Schindler's List film by Steven Spielberg, which has taken the testimonies we heard earlier on the show of 52,000 Holocaust survivors, the vast majority of them Jews, in creating a documentary archive of the experiences, a record, a true record of these these eyewitnesses and the survivors of the Shoah. Stephen, you come from England. Holocaust response, the ability to perceive how important the Shoah is, varies from country to country. What's the difference between how the British see the Shoah and how Americans see the Shoah?
Well, in Britain, I think, notwithstanding the proximity of Britain to the theater of the Second World War in Europe, in fact, it took a long time for Britain to come to terms with the significance of the Holocaust. I came from a non-Jewish background. I grew up in a Methodist home. And at the age of, in my teenage years, in the 1980s, following a visit to Israel, kind of went back to England expecting to be able to learn more about Jewish community and Jewish life and tradition and about the Holocaust. And there was no way and no one that was really speaking about that in Britain, including in the 1980s. So we came to it very late in Britain. When I left to come to the United States about 5 years ago, I was then, by this time, had opened the National Holocaust Museum in the UK and had also chaired the National Holocaust Memorial Day, which was founded by the British government.
And that was only in 2001 when they started that, correct?
That's right, yes. Yeah. So it happened very late, but actually today there is a very active community, including many, many non-Jews who are engaged in talking and teaching about the Holocaust. And although we hear quite negative things from Britain, because with good reason there is, many, many problems with anti-Semitism in Britain and across Europe, actually there is also a very active community, and about 2 million people participate in the National Holocaust Day each year. So a very, very big difference. In the United States of America, what I see is that it's a much more established. The Jewish community is larger. The Holocaust survivors have been more vocal for many more years, and many established Holocaust centers, and of course, Jewish federations that participate with their communities with around Yom HaShoah and so on.
Synagogues, very
active. Yeah, this time when we're commemorating Yom HaShoah across the nation, that the participation both within the Jewish community and through national and local governments is very impressive. So I think there is a greater openness to speaking about the Holocaust in the United States of America, which, of course, makes the work that we do at the USC Shoah Foundation very appropriate, that we can work with school districts and communities in a very open way.
I'm going to ask sort of a strange question. I've been participating in Yom HaShoah commemorations since I was a child. I have noticed that the numbers are not increasing at events that commemorate it. While there are far more museums, much more institutionalized approach to the Holocaust, lots more educational programs, people don't come out in the same way. Why do you think that is? What does it matter?
It's interesting because I think Yom HaShoah is a day for very much for the Jewish community. I remember speaking to a Holocaust survivor about the fact that the United Nations had established an International Holocaust Memorial Day on January the 27th. And I was asking her about the appropriateness of having 2 days. And what she said was, actually, Yom HaShoah for me is the day when I say Kaddish for my family. I don't know when and where most of them were murdered. And that's the day when I need time to reflect with my people, with my community, and to, remember and mourn my family. And the day on January 27th is the day I will go out and I will speak in schools and I will talk to the nation about my experiences as an educational day. And I thought that was a very interesting and good distinction to make about the difference between that which is personal and that which is public. And to some degree, I think it's important that there is always that time for personal reflection and a mourning and loss, because the loss of the Jewish communities of Europe under the Nazis will always be a loss for the Jewish community and will need that time of reflection. So I think over time one might start to see that distinction being made, the difference between our educational activities and those where we reflect more personally.
Steven Spielberg is obviously a highly accomplished guy. He's made films that have changed the way people think about movies. Is this his greatest accomplishment?
I think so, because this is like, if every single one of these testimonies it's like a movie in its own right. It's very difficult to describe the fact that we have 52,000 testimonies. Each survivor spoke for an average of just over 2 hours, which is about the length of a feature film.
Right.
And each one of them tells a totally unique story about their life and what unfolded, and the people that they could trust and those that they couldn't trust, and the separation of their loved ones, and the selection at the camps or the place that they were hiding. All of them immense dramas in their own right, and yet at the heart of each one is this powerful and challenging story about our values as humanity and who we are and what we are as a people. When you put all those 52,000 together, it's greater than the sum of their parts by a very long way. It is an immense contribution to our understanding of identity within the Jewish world, but also our identity as a human, the human race. Not to mention the fact that really this is an archive of human conscience that will be there for the world for all time.
In a way, it's 52,000 documentaries, isn't it?
That's what it's like. It's, you know, sometimes people ask, well, why can't I get more of this material? We have to understand this is, you know, it's like every single time when you download a testimony from the Shoah Foundation, it is the equivalent of downloading a full-length documentary. And so there's 52,000 of them in the archive. It's a very, very large archive, to the extent that if you were to press play and to watch it, all of the testimonies back to back, not only would you need to speak 32 languages to understand it, but it would take you 12 years, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year to watch that, to watch the archive.
It's kind of a strange question. It must be a huge storage issue.
Yes. One of the biggest challenges was, of course, you know, when a project such as this scale takes place, particularly as it was collected mainly in the 1990s, no video archive of anything like it had ever been created. So first of all, the data storage, that is digital data storage, was simply not up to scratch to be able to manage this amount of data. Now that's changing. You know, we're data storage is becoming much easier. But in order to be able to say to the survivors who Steven Spielberg had promised, we will look after your testimony in perpetuity, a very significant job had to be done in terms of digitizing that content and then creating the means to preserve it in perpetuity, which, as we know, is a very long time. So it becomes it's a very big commitment. And you know, thanks to the infrastructure of the University of Southern California, we now have that infrastructure, and we can say to the survivors, we know for certain that your testimony will be there for the future.
Can I ask, how many testimonies were taken, say, last year?
Well, now we scaled back our testimony taking program in the year 2000, partly because having collected 50,000 at that point, we wanted to ensure that we were starting to fulfill the second promise, which was to take the testimonies and to use them in education. And that alone, just to be able to create the kind of lessons and curricula and to be able to get access to it, was a gargantuan job. So now what we're doing is two things. We do, when we have a request from a Holocaust survivor or their family to take a testimony, we always try to do that. And, you know, get to them as and when we can. So it's a low number now that we take, you know, just in the tens each year. However, one of the things that we are doing is working with other Holocaust centers and museums to ensure that their testimonies that they may have taken separately to this particular archive are also have a place. So we actually took on 1,400 testimonies from San Francisco from the Bay Area collection that were taken in the 1980s and early 90s and incorporating those so that instead of those testimonies that were given to smaller Holocaust centers around the world sitting in closets and eventually, you know, becoming unplayable, what we're saying is we want to preserve that legacy and bring all of those testimonies to the Shoah Foundation so that we can look after them and make sure they're available to the world.
How does the Shoah Foundation work in the educational field besides providing this as a resource base?
Well, we're based at the University of Southern California now, which is an amazing opportunity for us to be working in higher education, firstly, and we obviously work on this campus, but we're associated to 50 other campuses around the world where we have formal partnerships and provide the archive so that students on university campuses and faculty can teach from the archive. The second thing is we have a wonderful platform that's designed very much for the 21st century, for our, you know, there's 14 to 18 year olds are in school now who only, you know, work in a digital environment. It's called Eyewitness, and we have a smaller version of the archive, just 1,500 testimonies in English, but it put in a format so that they can do activities around a whole variety of different subject areas and use the archive. And we also attached this Eyewitness platform to both the Yad Vashem and the U.S. Holocaust Museum digital archives so that students can now work in a very safe and trusted space where they're not going to be seeing Holocaust denial material or, you know, dubious material. They're going to work with three of the most, the finest archives in the world in their classrooms, and then they're able to use the testimonies and all of these photos and documents from the other archives and create their own projects. And it's an amazing thing to see how students from all walks of life and all backgrounds right across all 50 states of America are now using this archive in their classrooms.
So you must have been asked this many times. How does a guy growing up in a Methodist household make the Shoah a big part of his life's work?
Well, you know, I grew up in an environment where my parents, you know, were, my father was a Methodist minister and my mother was a religious education teacher. I did not see or experience anti-Semitism. In fact, on the contrary, my parents were very interested in understanding you know, how the Jewish world and the Jewish tradition informed the emergence of Christianity, to the extent that we went on a visit to go to Israel to go and visit the Holy Land. While I was there, I remember thinking to myself, how can we come here to learn about our tradition and where it comes from as Christians, but I don't know really what's going on here in terms of, I was standing at the Western Wall at the Kotel and thinking, this is amazing, but what's this all about?
Right.
So I began to explore a little bit, but the more I explored, the more I found that anti-Semitism was so much at the heart of the Christian history and doctrine and tradition that it really, really bothered me very deeply. And I thought I was going to, you know, pursue an academic career trying to understand anti-Semitism in the contemporary world. The more I looked at it, the more I realized that the Holocaust was the culmination of that in many ways, felt it was vitally important that non-Jewish people really tackle the issue of anti-Semitism, are outspoken on the issue of the Holocaust, and start to, you know, I saw the Holocaust as being a Jewish issue and a tragedy for the Jewish community, which of course it is and will be for all time. But as I came out of Yad Vashem with my brother James in 1991, we turned to each other and said, you know, this is an immense tragedy for the Jewish community, but the Jewish community, this wasn't the making of the Jewish world, they suffer the consequences of this. Where is everybody else on this matter? Because it's our responsibility to make sure that anti-Semitism is not a part of our future. And that's where we began.
I want to thank Stephen Smith for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about the work of the Shoah Foundation on this 20th anniversary?
Well, we have a wonderful site, the Shoah Foundation site, because you can just Google USC Shoah Foundation. But the website is sfi.usc.edu. It changes every day. There's new clips of testimony. There's wonderful stories about education, and you can dip into there and also search the archive there. So it's a wonderful resource for anybody interested in hearing from those wonderful survivors who gave us their testimonies.
I also want to congratulate you on being named the UNESCO Chair on Genocide Education and wish you luck in that important role as well.
Thank you so much, Rabbi. Appreciate it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Professor Aaron Wolf, a wonderful guest exploring water issues in the Middle East, how it can be used for peace and all around the globe. Our playout this morning for Yom HaShoah comes from the classic Yiddish song, Eli, Eli, my God, why have you forsaken me? Sung by the famous Shendele de Chaznete, perhaps the first woman ever to sing cantorial music, daughter of a cantor, and a feature of the Philadelphia Jewish community for many years. My friends, may you have a good observance of Yom HaShoah. May you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.